Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 8.
We've now come full circle. We began with Sartre's declaration that our being in the world is radically free, and we worked through his analysis of the way our being is for itself and for others. We've seen the conditions which situate human action, and we've examined the ultimate limit, our mortality. This brings us back to radical freedom and responsibility once again. In this circuit, we've developed the thought contained in Sartre's early and most influential philosophical book, Being and Nothingness, and in his early novels and plays as well. This is his existentialist philosophy, but it was not his final philosophy. To bring this presentation to a close, we need briefly to examine how his later thinking evolved. The themes of human freedom, human responsibility, and human involvement, the hallmarks of Sartre's existentialism, were fashioned before and during World War II. These themes were remarkably appropriate to the post-war period. Existentialist ideas took a significant place among the competing sources of inspiration for social and political renewal in France, and Sartre himself became almost at once a political figure. From 1945 until his death in 1980, he remained a controversial gadfly, a hated conscience in France and around much of the world. As he said in the famous lecture of 1945 at the Club Maintenon in Paris,
"I am obliged to want others to have freedom at the same time that I want my own freedom."
To Sartre, this meant social revolution. Very early in his life, he espoused the notion of class conflict. He was sensitive to the oppression of people wherever he saw it, among working people, peasants, blacks, third world people. Sartre believed this oppression was caused largely by the power of capitalist and colonialist elites. He hated everything about the middle class, which profits from these elites, and he hated himself for being a part of that middle class. So Sartre took every occasion he could find to champion the have-nots against the haves. Socialism, he thought, had to come. The question was how to help it along. Sartre struggled with the French Communist Party, at first taking a hostile position, then a vigorously supportive one. Later, he was more distanced and critical. He struggled with the Soviet Union in much the same way, back and forth, now supportive, now critical. Finally, when the Soviets invaded Hungary in 1956, Sartre took an independent course. He fought against the Cold War and the arms race. He fought against the French government's war in Algeria. He fought against the French in the American wars in Vietnam. He fought for Israeli-Arab peace and for innumerable small causes and little people, and so on and so on. Through these political involvements, Sartre's philosophical ideas subtly changed. He remained convinced of the basic doctrine of freedom, but he came to see less and less scope for us to exercise that freedom. While he still believed that choice is necessary, he saw more and more complexity in it. He came to see all action as a mixture of good and evil. While human beings still are responsible, it seemed to Sartre that they're much more subject to circumstance than he'd thought before. Sartre had earlier insisted that individual existence is the central element in human affairs, but now he increasingly emphasized the massive presence and power of the economic and social world as it impinges on individuals. He struggled to write a theory of ethics, but he couldn't see how to put morality and politics together. The theory never was completed. Through several new plays and books, he struggled with the uses of violence, seeing both that violence can become self-destructive and that political action necessarily involves it. Sartre knew he had to confront Marxist thought, so he undertook a huge study in the philosophy of history, which he called the Critique of Dialectical Reason. In this work, he tried to bring his existentialism together with a much modified Marxism. He envisioned for the first time the possibility that separate individuals, in a fusion of their projects, might act decisively against oppression. Armed with these ideas, Sartre continued to encourage radical causes, including the student uprising of May 1968 in Paris. He defended the student violence as counterviolence provoked by the police. He insisted the students were expressing a legitimate desire for a new political order. Claude Lévi-Strauss, the great anthropologist, denounced Sartre.
"Since May 1968, all intellectual objectivity has been repudiated in France. The position of the youth corresponds to that of Sartre."
Still, Sartre persisted. He continued to speak out on political matters, to edit and write for his literary magazine, Le Temps Moderne. And through it all, as an undercurrent, Sartre labored on a multi-volume critical analysis of the 19th century novelist Gustave Flaubert. By considering Flaubert, Sartre tried to define the complex relations between a writer and the political struggles of the time in which he writes. How did all this political and literary activity affect Sartre's thinking? He described his philosophical development to an interviewer in 1969.
I will try to explain autobiographically certain aspects of my early work, which may help to clarify the reasons why my outlook changed so fundamentally after the Second World War. A simple formula would be to say that life taught me la force des choses, the power of circumstances. For my state of mind during those early years, I think that the first plays I wrote are very symptomatic. I called them A Theater of Freedom. The other day, I reread a prefatory note of mine to a collection of these plays, The Flies, No Exit, and others, and was truly scandalized. I had written, whatever the circumstances and wherever the site, a man is always free to be a traitor or not. When I read this, I said to myself, it's incredible. I actually believed that. To understand how I could have done so, you must remember that there was a very simple problem during the resistance. Ultimately, only a question of courage. One had to accept the risks involved in what one was doing. But beyond this, a Frenchman was either for the Germans or against them. There was no other option. The real political problems of being for some policy, but with some qualifications, or against something, but not completely, were not posed by this experience. The result was that I concluded that in any circumstances, there is always a possible choice. Which is false. Indeed, it is so false that I later wanted precisely to refute myself by creating a character in another play, The Devil and the Good Lord, Heinrich, who cannot choose. He wants to choose, of course, but he cannot choose either the church, which has abandoned the poor, or the poor, who have abandoned the church. He is thus a living contradiction, who will never choose. He is totally conditioned by his situation.
But all this, Sartre says, he understood only much later.
What the drama of the war gave me, as it did everyone who participated in it, was the experience of heroism. Not my own, of course. All I did was run a few errands. But the militant in the resistance who was caught and tortured became a myth for us. He either speaks or refuses to speak. This is what I mean by the experience of heroism, which is a false experience. After the war came the true experience, that of society. But I think it was necessary for me to pass via the myth of heroism first. For the idea which I have never ceased to develop is that in the end, one is always responsible for what is made of one. Even if one can do nothing else besides assume this responsibility. For I believe that a man can always make something out of what is made of him.
Here in these few words is the new Sartre. He says, a man can always make something out of what is made of him. But his earlier conviction was that a man can make himself. He had said a man projected himself toward the future and created the meaning of his life. Now the human agent does not make himself. In Sartre's words, he makes something out of what is made of him. He developed a much more cautious and socially realistic view, as he goes on to conclude.
This is the limit I would today accord to freedom. The small movement which makes of a totally conditioned social being someone who does not render back completely what his conditioning had given him.
Well, indeed, this is a different Jean-Paul Sartre from the man of the heroic days. As he said, he's encountered society and history. He now believes social and historical conditions impose their meanings on us and leave us little or no room to move. Sartre earlier had described the power of individual freedom, the for itself, also the brute reality which situates us, the in itself. Now, for Sartre, there's a third reality, namely the structures of social practice. These fundamental social structures include the economic and political system, the family, our language, and so forth. They mediate all human action. And Sartre gives them a collective name, the practico inert. They are the inherited results of our past practice. In a sense, they are inert until we take them up. But they're strangely powerful, too. They make us what we are and form parts of any human action. To act, we must find paths of action which these structures of social practice make possible for us. And so, Sartre concludes,
the individual interiorizes his social determinations. He interiorizes the relations of production, the family of his childhood, the historical past, the contemporary institutions. And he then re-exteriorizes these in acts and options, which necessarily refer us back to them.
For the later Sartre, human beings are much more clearly social selves and economic selves when they exercise their freedom. In Sartre's words, we re-exteriorize in our actions what we've interiorized from the social reality around us. As he'd said before, we can give back only a bit more than our conditioning gives to us. But Sartre says we can and must do that. It's important to see here that the basic ideas of Sartre's existential philosophy are still with him. After all, existential freedom always had a reciprocal relationship with the historical, social, and other conditions that situated. But Sartre now gives these conditions much greater force. There is still freedom, even if it's reduced in scope, and there's still responsibility, though much less individualistic. Within limits, we still can come to understand our situation. We still have an opening on the world. We can give more to the world than we get from our conditioning. And if we manage to affect the social realities which affect us, we can still make some difference. From start to finish, through its many twists and turns, Sartre's philosophy and his own life express a consistent theme. We must strive to be free, honest, and involved. We must try to make a difference. Jean-Paul Sartre was a flawed human being in many ways. He was totally consumed by work and could allow only a few people near him. He certainly interiorized and then re-exteriorized a lot of his own childhood experience. He reflected his own social context in what he thought and did, but he gave back a great deal more than he got. Sartre genuinely tried to think out the meaning of the way he lived and to live the implications of his own thinking. He stood for something. He was scorned by many, yet he captured the imagination and affection of many others. Though Sartre relished his popular role, he never thought of himself as important. He refused the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1964 because he believed a writer should rely only on his words, not on honors, to persuade his readers. Sartre said he didn't want to allow himself to be transformed into an institution, but he became one nonetheless. When he was buried on April 19, 1980, more than 50,000 people followed his cortege through the streets of Paris.
This concludes Knowledge Products, The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston.